It may be uncomfortable for you to reflect upon this, or it may not, but still, you will eat. There are accounts which, if we open our hearts to them, will cut us too deeply. Look, here is a good man, good by his own lights and the lights of his friends. He is faithful and true to his wife. He adores and lavishes attention on his little children. He cares about his country. He does his job punctiliously as best he can. So, efficiently and good-naturedly, he exterminates Jews. He appreciates the music that plays in the background to pacify them. He advises the Jews not to forget their identification numbers as they go into the showers. Many people, he tells them, forget their numbers and take the wrong clothes when they come out of the showers. This calms the Jews. There will be life, they assure themselves, after the showers. And they are wrong. Our man supervises the detail taking the bodies to the ovens, and if there is anything he feels bad about, it is that he still allows the gassing of vermin to affect him. Were he a truly good man, he knows, he would feel nothing but joy as the earth is cleansed of its pests. Leave him. He cuts too deep. He is too close to us, and it hurts. There was a girl, and her uncle sold her. But like that, it seems so simple. No man, proclaimed Dunn, is an island. And he was wrong. If we were not islands, we would be lost, drowned in each other's tragedies. We are insulated, a word that means literally, remember, made into an island, from the tragedy of others, by our island nature, and by the repetitive shape and form of the stories. We know the shape, and the shape does not change. There was a human being who was born, lived, and then, by some means or other, died. There. You may fill in the details from your own experience, as unoriginal as any other tale, as unique as any other life. Lives are snowflakes, unique in detail, forming patterns we have seen before, but as like one another as peas in a pod. And have you ever looked at peas in a pod? I mean, really looked at them? There's not a chance you'd mistake one for another after a minute's close inspection. We need individual stories. Without individuals, we see only numbers. 1,000 dead. 100,000 dead. Casualties may rise to 1,000,000. With individual stories, the statistics become people. But even that is a lie. For the people continue to suffer in numbers that themselves are numbing and meaningless. Look. See the child's swollen, swollen belly, and the flies that crawl at the corners of his eyes, his skeletal limbs. Will it make it easier for you to know his name, his age, his dreams, his fears, to see him from the inside? And if it does, are we not doing a disservice to his sister, who lies in the searing dust beside him, a distorted, distended caricature of a human child? And there, if we feel for them, are they now more important to us than 1,000 other children, touched by the same famine, 1,000 other young lives who will soon be food for the fly's own myriad squirming children? We draw our lines around these moments of pain and remain upon our islands, and they cannot hurt us. They are covered with a smooth, safe, nacreous layer to let them slip, pearl-like, from our souls without real pain. Fiction allows us to slide into these other heads, these other places, and look out through other eyes. And then in the tale, we stop before we die, or we die vicariously and unharmed, and in the world beyond the tale, we turn the page or close the book, and we resume our lives. A life which is like any other, unlike any other. And the simple truth is this. There was a girl, and her uncle sold her. This is what they used to say, where the girl came from. No man may be certain who fathered a child, but the mother, Ah, that you could be certain of. Lineage and property was something that moved in the matrilineal line, but power remained in the hands of the men. A man had complete ownership of his sister's children. There was a war in that place, and it was a small war, no more than a skirmish between the men of two rival villages. It was almost an argument. One village won the argument, one village lost it. Life is a commodity, people as possessions. Enslavement had been part of the culture of those parts for thousands of years. The Arab slavers had destroyed the last of the great kingdoms of East Africa, while the West African nations had destroyed each other. There was nothing untoward or unusual about their uncle selling the twins. Although twins were considered magical beings, and their uncle was scared of them, scared enough that he did not tell them that they were to be sold in case they harmed his shadow and killed him. They were 12 years old. She was called Wututu, the messenger bird. He was called Agasu, the name of a dead king. They were healthy children, and, because they were twins, male and female, they were told many things about the gods. And because they were twins, they listened to the things that they were told, and they remembered. Their uncle was a fat and lazy man. If he had owned more cattle, perhaps he would have given up one of his cattle instead of the children. But he did not. He sold the twins. Enough of him. He shall not enter further into this narrative. We follow the twins. They were marched with several other slaves, taken or sold in the war, for a dozen miles to a small outpost. Here they were traded, and the twins, along with 13 others, were bought by 6 men with spears and knives who marched them to the west, toward the sea, and then for many miles along the coast. There were 15 slaves now altogether, their hands loosely bound, tied neck to neck. Wututu asked her brother Agasu what would happen to them.
"I do not know," he said.
Agasu was a boy who smiled often. His teeth were white and perfect, and he showed them as he grinned, his happy smiles making Wututu happy in her turn. He was not smiling now. Instead, he tried to show bravery for his sister, his head back and shoulders spread, as proud, as menacing, as comical as a puppy with its hackles raised. The man in the line behind Wututu, his cheeks scarred, said,
"They will sell us to the white devils, who will take us to their home across the water."
"And what will they do to us there?"
demanded Wututu. The man said nothing.
"Well?"
asked Wututu. Agasu tried to dart a glance over his shoulder. They were not allowed to talk or sing as they walked.
"It is possible they will eat us,"
said the man.
"That is what I've been told. That is why they need so many slaves. It is because they are always hungry."
Wututu began to cry as she walked. Agasu said,
"Do not cry, my sister. They will not eat you. I shall protect you. Our gods will protect you."
But Wututu continued to cry, walking with a heavy heart, feeling pain and anger and fear as only a child can feel it, raw and overwhelming. She was unable to tell Agasu that she was not worried about the white devils eating her. She would survive. She was certain of it. She cried because she was scared that they would eat her brother, and she was not certain that she could protect him. They reached a trading post, and they were kept there for 10 days. In the morning of the 10th day, they were taken from the hut in which they had been imprisoned. It had become very crowded in the final days, as men arrived from far away, some of them from hundreds of miles, bringing their own strings and skeins of slaves. They were marched to the harbor, and Wututu saw the ship that was to take them away. Her first thought was how big a ship it was. Her second, that it was too small for all of them to fit inside. It sat lightly on the water. The ship's boat came back and forth, ferrying the captives to the ship, where they were manacled and arranged in low decks by sailors some of whom were brick red or tan-skinned, with strange pointy noses and beards that made them look like beasts. Several of the sailors looked like her own people, like the men who had marched her to the coast. The men and the women and the children were separated, forced into different areas on the slave deck.